Hey, I'm Tom Power. I'm the host of the podcast Q with Tom Power, where we talk to all kinds of artists, actors, writers, musicians, painters. We had Green Day on the other day talking about their huge album, American Idiot. Nicole Byer came on to talk about ADHD and comedy. And then there's Dan Levy. While we were talking about filmmaking, we talked about his insecurities.
I sometimes feel like I have this desire to, like, perform, to be a version of myself that people might like.
Listen to Q with Tom Power to hear your favorite artists as they truly are, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Nora Young. This is Spark. If you love clothes, learning about the environmental cost of fast fashion is a wake-up call. But new research aims to produce novel, more sustainable textiles using organisms like yeast, fungus, and bacteria. And from precious dyes that made fortunes to bolts of cloth as currency, textiles have long been linked to money, power, and politics. So today, in an episode that first aired in May of 2023, the surprising history and creative future of textile tech. Textiles are one of civilization's oldest technologies. In fact, the root word of textiles comes from to weave, and it's the same root of the word technology. So you might think we've invented just about everything we can, but there are all kinds of high-tech innovations in the textile field these days. Smart fabrics, electronic textiles, high-performance fabric. But here's a freaky idea. What if you could grow your textiles?
Microbes, specifically bacteria and fungi, as actually sort of living factories or ways of producing materials at a really efficient scale.
This is Jen Keane.
I'm the co-founder and CEO of Modern Synthesis. We're a London-based company crafting the next generation of materials with biology. I came to London to look at how can we fundamentally rethink manufacturing and look a little bit back at nature and how nature has developed materials. And so microbial weaving came out of early collaborations and discussions with scientists at Imperial College London. And I have a background in textiles. And so working with these scientists, I learned not only the incredible material properties of the materials that these bacteria produce, but also just inspired by the way that these bacteria produce them and the possibility for us to collaborate with these living systems and not only displace materials that we have today, but actually design and create new ways and really build an exciting new future in terms of performance as well as design.
Okay, so how do you actually create something using this particular bacteria?
Yeah, so the bacteria that we use was isolated and sequenced from kombucha tea by my co-founder Ben almost a decade ago. And if you have made kombucha tea, it creates this SCOBY, so this sort of pellicle of material that sits on top of the fermentation. And so that's a byproduct of these bacteria and also yeast and other organisms going through a fermentation process. And what the bacteria are actually doing in that is they're creating these tiny, tiny fibers called nanocellulose. And so they're converting sugar into this tiny fiber. And so cellulose, for example, is the building block of the natural world. So it's in leaves, it's cotton, it's wood. It's a polymer that's in almost everything that you'll find in nature. And nanocellulose is the strongest, finest form of that. Basically, these bacteria convert that sugar into these really fine streams, fibers. And those fibers themselves are really strong. So they're 8 times stronger than steel and stiffer than Kevlar. So you can imagine the performance potential there. But even more interestingly, they bind to themselves. So if you can imagine like how your hair knots up on its own, it's kind of like that, but a lot smaller. And they bind to themselves and create these fine webs of material that are really strong and really lightweight. And so what we've done in our process is we've taken this natural ability, these fibers, to create these really strong films and combined that with a textile. So we take a textile, like a yarn, it could be cotton or any other natural yarn, and we form the nanocellulose around that. So you get a material that is partially like a traditional textile and partially like a film. like a plastic film that you know today, or a lightweight nylon transparent. It looks a lot like that, mm-hmm. but it's completely natural. So you can achieve these really sort of technical synthetic aesthetics, but with a material that is fully cellulosic. So it's fully natural, which means that it could be recycled or biodegradable naturally.
So it sounds like you're almost making a sort of a, like a kind of scaffolding, and then the bacteria sort of fills in the blanks in the scaffolding. Is that about right?
Yeah, exactly. So we're creating a scaffold, and then we form the material around that. And we've come a long way since the original shoe. So when I was doing my MA, I grew the upper of a shoe to demonstrate the potential of this technology. And that was a single piece upper. So it was one thread of yarn that was put into a particular pattern that then the bacteria grew around to form the end material. And since then, we've come a long way at Modern Synthesis, where we've taken that process and we've really looked at scalability and how we can break that down into different parts, utilize existing machinery to form that material in different ways to make not just one material or one example like this shoe, but actually a whole variety of materials for different applications.
I see. And where does the sugar that the bacteria uses come from?
It can come from many sources. So one of the great things about these bacteria and a lot of the conversations that we're having now in biomaterials is feedstocks. And the great thing about these particular type of bacteria is they're feedstock agnostic, which means they can use any type of sugar. So for example, we could use waste sugars from cider production here in the UK. There's also really cool technologies coming out at the moment where you can convert agricultural waste. You know, leaves from other production and convert that actually back into these raw sugars that we can use in the production of the material.
And so what sorts of advantages would this offer distinct from weaving or knitting a material as we now do?
Yeah, so there's different families of materials today. Ours is, we've considered it a non-woven material. So other non-woven materials that you would know today are like leather or vegan leather, which is basically usually a synthetic film added to a textile, or sort of lightweight performance applications and materials. So by being able to make these types of materials through our process is one, sort of the environmental impact. So if you can think about efficiency of, you know, growing a cow versus actually just going straight from sugar to end material, you're reducing a lot of process steps, which means that you're taking out all of that water use, all the land that needs to be used to either grow those crops like cotton or livestock. And so you're just reducing the amount of inputs that you need that then reduces carbon emissions. But also the end material, unlike a lot of synthetic materials, is again, fully natural. So it can easily integrate into the Earth's natural recycling systems, but also feed into a lot of burgeoning systems around cellulose recycling. And so we can actually build these closed loop recycling systems without all the plastics, because that's a big challenge at the moment is even though a lot of the polymers you talk about sort of recycled PET bottles or even recycled textiles, a lot of that still gets out of the loop and then pollutes the environment significantly.
Yeah. I can imagine a lot of people are thinking, what happens to the microbes afterwards? Am I walking around in clothes covered in bacteria or what happens in the end?
I mean, I get that question a lot. So there's no actual bacteria left in the textiles. So the bacteria are really, we're collaborating with them to make the material itself, but then they're washed out at the end. And I think this is something that we need to talk a little bit more as a culture, and that there's many other similar processes that we have in our day-to-day lives today. I mean, beer is a great example of a fermentation process that's very similar. Yogurt also has live bacteria in it. And these bacteria are really like they're edible, and you'll find them in many food and beauty products today, actually.
You're listening to Spark from your friends at CBC Radio.
I'm I'm Nora Young, and today on Spark, we're talking about innovations in textiles, and in particular, biofabrication, using organisms to create new kinds of fabrics and more sustainable production. Right now, my guest is Jen Keane. She's the co-founder and CEO of Modern Synthesis. They're working to develop a microcellulose textile by co-creating with bacteria.
Building these new systems for biomanufacturing allows us to move away some of these more harmful, but also allows us to create new materials because we can learn from the way that biology produces different things and actually start to engineer new materials that can break down when we need them to.
Hmm. So the idea here is you get a sort of cradle to cradle type of idea that you're potentially using the waste to create the materials and then biodegrading them or in some way returning them back into the system, like a closed loop?
Exactly. It's really designing a closed loop the way that nature does. So you can design an end product from inception. So from an organism or from a nanoscale, you can really design the properties that you need for the lifespan that that material needs to have in the product that you're designing so that it can also then return to the loop after it's been used.
Mm-hmm. How far can this approach go in really addressing the environmental impact of apparel as long as we're still tied to this kind of constant consumption pattern of fast fashion? Like, what if we just made clothes out of cotton or wool and didn't buy as many of them and kept them longer?
I mean, this is the universal challenge, right? We 100% need to use our clothes longer. We also need to make use of what we have. And there's a lot that needs to happen in the short term to just make the systems that we have more sustainable. And a lot of that comes down to, you know, energy usage, optimizing the process that we have. Where biomaterials comes in the long run is actually moving away from these existing materials because we're going to start needing to use that land for food production as well. So yes, I mean, a universal way would just be use less, keep it in the system. Unfortunately, our societies aren't really built for that at the moment. And there's also a lot of people that rely on these industries for their economies and for work. And so it's not a shift that we can happen really overnight. And what I'd like to see in the future is where we can actually imbue more value into these products. And that's where biomanufacturing and these new biomaterials gets really exciting, in that you can actually be more conscious as a designer in building a product for its use cases and also moving back to sort of local manufacturing and really connecting with the supply chain more will hopefully also influence the consumption patterns that we've developed over the last decades.
Mm-hmm. Beyond what Modern Synthesis is doing, my understanding is that synthetic biology broadly would mean genetically modifying microorganisms to be used in production. Are there safety concerns associated with this or even consumer acceptance concerns?
Definitely. I mean, our materials at the moment are not genetically modified. So we've done incredible work with scientists who are pioneering in this field to do genetic modification on these microbes and other types. And I think there's going to be huge advantages to that in the future. But in the short term, there's a lot that we can actually do with natural organisms. So we're working on how we can take full advantage of the existing materials that we have today. But in terms of synthetic biology long term, there are huge advantages in terms of both sustainability and also performance that can be built in from a genetic level. And of course, there's disadvantages and there's advantages to all new technologies. Our approach has really been, we want to make sure that everyone's talking about this. There should be legislation, but there is huge sort of gray areas. For example, genetic engineering is actually already used quite widespread within the materials industry. For example, I think almost 90% of the world's cotton is already GMO. The problem in this case isn't actually the GMOs themselves. The plants, or the cotton plants in this case, are more efficient. They use less water. It's actually more sustainable and more efficient to produce the cotton that way. The problem actually in that case is more the human exploitation of it. And this is where legislation needs to be brought in to make sure that these technologies are controlled in a way that is fair and equitable, and actually we can reap the benefits as a whole, as a society. I think the best way to make sure that legislation is put in place is being really transparent about these new developments. But again, there are ways to control it in terms of manufacturing, by building closed loop systems, making sure that you're designing the organisms so that if they were to get out, they wouldn't cause any harm to the existing environment. So we need to be incredibly careful. But I also see huge potential of these technologies to do good.
Yeah. So just to return to the work that Modern Synthesis is doing, what are some of the remaining challenges in bringing the technology that you're working on to market?
For us, the big focus is really on optimizing for scalability. One of the biggest challenges in biomaterials to this date is conquering that scaling challenge. And there's a few things that go into that. One, we're trying to scale a lot faster than previous technologies have had. If you think about Lycra or elastane, sort of the stretchy material that's in a lot of our clothes today, that had, you know, 30 years of development to get to the scale that it is used now. To make a real difference in this space, we need to scale a lot faster than that. And so what we're having to do is parallelize a lot of work to sort of retrofit existing machinery as much as possible to transform for these new manufacturing. And that's borrowing from food industry. It's borrowing from textiles industry to really create a new supply chain. And it's been a challenge, I would say, for other companies in this space, simply because maybe if there's availability of feedstocks or availability of infrastructure, for example, with mycelium, to grow enough mycelium, they've had to actually build a lot of this manufacturing ourselves. I think we've got a huge advantage in that bacterial nanocellulose has been produced at scale for other industries for years. It's used in medical applications, it's used in food. So we can tap into not only that knowledge, but also those capacities to scale up quite quickly.
It's really fascinating and quite beautiful. Thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you for having me.
Jen Keane is co-founder and CEO of Modern Synthesis, a biofabrication company based in London, UK. If you'd like to see a picture of a shoe prototype produced using bacteria, you can find it at our website, cbc.ca/spark.
Yes, boys, this is it. This is a synthetic fiber. We call it rayon.
You mean we make cloth out of that?
Yes, we do.
I'm Nora Young, and today on Spark, we're talking about biodesign, designing and creating textiles by working with organisms in hopes of building a more sustainable apparel industry. Now, as you heard, using waste sugar and bacteria is just one approach to designing textiles with organisms. How broadly can we borrow from biology and natural processes to make new textiles?
The thing is, most materials are biomaterials, even the existing ones, cotton, you know, even our polyesters, it's derived from oil, you know, we mine it from the ground. But the difference really with this is actually working with biology and working with natural systems and living systems so that they start to become living factories, factories that are producing materials for us. So my name's Hannah Hansel. I'm an artist and an academic, and my research really focuses on the future of the fashion and textile industry, and particularly fabrication and production in the context of biodesign. I think sometimes when you talk about synthetic biology, it can frighten people. It can seem quite unknown, and the potential of manipulating life, which essentially is what is happening. But a lot of the techniques and processes that are happening are not that far off of things that we've been doing for hundreds of years around cultivation, crossbreeding, you know, how we make beer, how we make kombucha, So it's not really that far off.
So how do we get from kombucha to a cozy sweater? What do synthetic biology, biodesign, and biofabrication mean when it comes to textiles?
Biodesign is the wider term. Biofabrication is more about the process, working with living systems to produce different kind of materials. So a lot of the work has been focused on working with things like mycelium or working with different microbes like algae and bacteria to create naturally occurring polymers. So things like cellulose, which is naturally occurring in plants as well as animals.
Yeah. Can we dig into the sustainability aspect a little bit more? How can biofabrication be more sustainable than traditional textile manufacture?
Yeah, I mean, I think the main thing is that it offers the opportunity to really condense the production process. So at the moment, if you think about something like a cotton t-shirt, you'd be growing the cotton on the land. It takes a lot of water use. There's a high pesticide use within cotton. Then it has to be picked, it has to be separated, it has to be cleaned before it's even then spun, made into a material. Then it gets shipped somewhere else to be made into clothing, then, you know, finishing, and then shipped again. So whereas working with some of the biofabrication processes, because you're growing, you can do a lot of those things all together.
I see.
So with the cellulosic-based materials, you can even grow them in vats that are shaped into the pattern pieces if you want to.
Wow. That's very cool.
That's some of what they're doing at Modern Synthesis, as I understand. And that was something that I did in the biotunic piece as well. I made my own individual grow vats.
So you're not essentially making like a bolt of cloth and then cutting it. You're growing it so that it will be the shape that it's intended to be at the end.
Yeah. And in that sense, very much using principles within nature, because nature often will only make what it needs within natural biological systems.
Yeah.
It doesn't create waste most of the time, or, you know, byproducts are used in different ways. It's very, very efficient and economical.
Mm-hmm. And so part of the promise here is that we can create these circular closed loop systems. So it's not only that it's more efficient in production, but it's more efficient in what happens to the products after no one wants to wear them anymore. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, that's something that I'm also particularly interested in and trying to work a bit more on at the moment in new work, the sort of the aftercare of these materials. I find it quite interesting that, you know, we wouldn't necessarily wash them in a conventional way.
Hmm.
Not necessarily all of them. I think it's a lot of the materials that are being developed in industry, they might go through a similar cleaning process. But,
okay.
I mean, imagine if you could develop a material that, rather than putting it in the washing machine, you put it into a nutrient vat where you could then have bacteria that mended the fabric as well as cleaning it.
Uh-huh.
So how would that change the way that we wash and care for our garments? Would our wardrobes completely change?
Yeah. Can we talk a little bit more about that? Can you paint me a picture of what clothing might be like if this mode of production becomes economically viable? I mean, I realize it's somewhat speculative, but can you paint me a picture?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is really hard to know, because I think in many senses, not much might change, because the transition to these kind of materials in terms of making it successful and consumers actually getting on board, there needs to be a process of there being some recognizable qualities to the materials and garments that we're making. But then at the same time, you know, I think there is the possibility for things to really shift, that we don't necessarily see our clothing as being something that isn't living.
Hmm.
You know, imagine if you could have a pair of jeans that actually kind of lived and died with you.
Huh.
That, you know, we started to use things like entropy in the design process. Would we be more connected to our garments and less likely to throw them away if they had more of a living life cycle to them? So I guess I see my ideal, I see that future as being something where we have potentially these new biological processes could help to connect us to our clothing more effectively, emotionally and physically.
We knew further progress might be found in something other than natural fibers for our clothes. We said, find something with all the good things of natural fibers and none of the drawbacks. That's when the test tube boys knuckled down to work.
I'm Nora Young, and right now my guest is design researcher Hannah Hansel. We're talking about experiments in creating new types of textiles that can be more sustainable to produce, wear, and recycle. Do you think our perception of what apparel can do might change? I mean, for example, you know, I've seen experiments with these, maybe it was even in your research, with bioluminescent clothes that kind of glow. Are there ways that we might think about how apparel behaves differently?
I hope so. Yeah, there was a really interesting piece by Victoria Gini. She was a RCA graduate. Yes, I would love to see it moving in that direction. That was something that I was trying to speculate in the Living Collection piece that I did. So the idea behind that was a set of underwear that was not only created by mycelium, but then actually had living bacteria set within it. So you would wear the underwear and the bacteria would have been trained to eat sweat microbes.
Oh.
So how we could actually have a symbiotic relationship with bacteria potentially in the future. But then also the idea behind that piece was trying to elicit how we would feel about that. Would that be a step too far? That we wouldn't want to have that kind of interaction with microbes.
What about public acceptance of some of these fabrics? Like, how do you convince somebody to wear something on their bodies that comes from bacteria or fungus, for example?
I think it's just all about education and awareness. Because a lot of the time, unlike that piece I was just talking about, most of the materials that are being developed at the moment, they don't have bacteria in them. They are fabricated by bacteria. So actually, the material that is being made, for example, like the nanocellulose they're making at Modern Synthesis, it's a cellulose. The cell makes a cellulose, and cellulose is all around us. It's in the plants all around us. So I think it's about education.
Mm-hmm. How far do you think we could go with this in terms of sustainability? I mean, is the problem just the technology of manufacture, or is the problem still our addiction to fast fashion?
No, I think it's bigger than the technology. I think that there's opportunities to really question the relationships that we have, not only with our clothing, but with the natural world as well. You know, it offers an opportunity to really question the structures and the systems that we're existing in within production and manufacture, but economically as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think we really need to think about how we not only move towards more regenerative production systems, but also towards more regenerative cultures, where we're thinking more about circularity and collaboration, stewardship of the land, and really caring for the planet. You know, we have to. We're in a climate emergency. There's no getting around that.
Yeah. Hannah, thanks so much for your insights on this.
Thank you.
Hannah Hansel is an artist and an academic. Her research focuses on the future of fashion and the textile industry, particularly on fabrication and production in the context of biodesign.
From the Spark Archives, 2016, Alice Nasto, on developing a wetsuit inspired by beaver pelts.
In sports technology, there's a big need for textiles that have great insulating properties in water, but still let you stay agile and nimble. And there's lots of examples in nature that are really interesting that you can emulate to develop new technologies and interesting textiles there. Beavers, otters, fur seals, all kind of share similar properties. So first of all, their fur is very dense.
Uh-huh.
And if you look at their fur under a microscope, it has an interesting texture that people have hypothesized helps to keep the hairs entangled and keep the air trapped in their pelts. Our substance is just hexagonal arrangements of hairs. They're made of rubber this isn't necessarily exactly what it's like in nature, but the idea is to make a simple model to begin to understand.
Right. So it doesn't look like you're wearing a beaver pelt or an otter pelt if you had this thing on.
You know, I wouldn't put this on and dive in water and say, ah, it works. It's more of a tool for understanding the mathematical model behind how to predictably understand how some sort of texture would work in water.
Right.
This has all already been done, but we just kind of have to look around us and try to figure out just how it's been done. Any mechanism that exists in fluid mechanics or physics has probably been employed by some creature somewhere in nature. So you just have to look and see how they take advantage of the physics that surrounds them.
I'm Dr. Brian Goldman, host of the CBC podcast, The Dose. Each week, we answer health topics in a smart and sometimes counterintuitive way you won't hear anywhere else. Like, what's the least amount of exercise I can do to get the benefits? Which psychedelics can improve my mental health? And how can I check for cancer if I don't have a family doctor? Top experts help me bring you what you need to know in plain language in about 20 minutes. Find The Dose on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Nora Young, this time on Spark, an episode that first aired in May 2023, all about new approaches to textile design. While the idea of co-producing textiles with bacteria is cutting edge, the long history of textiles is also a history of technological innovation, right down to the word itself.
If you take it all the way back to the Indo-European root, it comes from a root called tex, which means to weave. And that is the same root that we get the word technology from. And weaving was very associated with the Greek words that are the roots of the word technology, because it was one of the central technologies of ancient Greece.
This is Virginia Postrel. She's a columnist, speaker, and the author most recently of The Fabric of Civilization, How Textiles Made the World. In it, she shows how textiles were so important in societies that they made fortunes, symbolized power and status, and drove innovation. So before you have cloth, you have to have thread, which, as you discuss in the book, was very labor-intensive. In fact, you write that manual spinning was the bottleneck in production, and yet we don't even think about that process today. So what was involved in spinning thread, and how did that process get streamlined?
Well, what spinning does is it makes thread long and strong. So you're twisting fibers so that they press against each other in a essentially helical structure that creates strength. When you see somebody who is a good spinner, it looks like magic. It looks like they're bringing something out of nothing. They have these lightly ordered fibers and they're making something very structured out of them. And in fact, it was a metaphor for life and creation and birth and many different mythologies. Mm. But it actually takes a really long time to make enough thread to make any significant amount of cloth. And that's just because it takes a lot of thread to make anything. So if you take the cloth in a typical pair of blue jeans, it's about 6 miles or 10 kilometers of thread.
Wow.
And the fastest and best spinners in the world before the Industrial Revolution, who were in India using a wheel called the charka, it would have taken them 100 hours to spin that much thread. So it was this bottleneck in production where women, it was very much a female job, all around the world were spending all their time spinning. And then if you look at a very specific place where we have the origins of the Industrial Revolution, you look in Britain in the late 18th century, it's a big textile production site, but the weavers sometimes were idle for lack of thread or yarn to feed their looms, because even with 20, 30 people spinning for every weaver, there wasn't enough thread in some cases.
Yeah. Can we talk a little bit about weaving? Because there's this fascinating relationship between math, computer science, and the history of weaving cloth. What can you tell me about that?
Well, weaving, first of all, is the original binary technology because a thread is either up or down. You're either going over it or under it. There is a fundamentally binary quality to it. And many people will tell me, did you know that Loom was the first computer? And that's not exactly right. But what they're thinking of is the way Jean-Marie Jacquard automated the weaving of very complex patterns. Typically, when you're weaving, you have a bar of some type that lifts a whole bunch of threads at once, and you send a shuttle across under those or over those, depending on the structure of the loom, and you get repetitive patterns. But it's very hard to make a picture, like a bird or a flower. And in order to do that, there were very complicated looms that required multiple people and people holding individual threads. And so what Jacquard did was he came out with a way of automating it where you had punch cards, where depending on whether there was a hole or not in the punch card, a thread would lift individually. And each punch card was one pass across the loom. And this inspired Charles Babbage, who was thinking about early computing, to think about how it might work. Now, his analytical engine didn't actually happen in the real world. It was more of a theoretical concept. But Ada Lovelace, who worked with him, famously wrote that the analytical engine would weave algebra the way the Jacquard loom would weave cloth. So that was an inspiration. And those of us who are old enough to remember the 1970s, there was a period where punch cards were actually what held your program.
Yes.
There's also a less well-known aspect of the early history of computing where the initial, whether it was programs or data, were stored on essentially a woven structure of copper wires that was called magnetic core memory. And you had a little magnetic donut at the intersection. I mean, these donuts are like the size of a pencil point, but at the intersection of each warp and weft in weaving terms, the copper threads. And that wasn't modeled on weaving. It just fell out of the essentially binary nature of weaving.
So there's weaving, and yet today most of our clothes are knitted, not woven. Why is that?
That is really a new phenomenon. And there are at least two reasons. One is simply comfort. We like these stretchy clothes that move with us, and knitting is intrinsically stretchier than, even without spandex, is intrinsically stretchier than woven cloth. The other has to do with the setup times, because you can change the thread much more quickly, even on modern machines in knitting, than you can on a loom. And that feeds into certain technological developments that are happening today. Most knitted fabric, like in a typical t-shirt, will actually have been knitted in a big cylinder and then sliced into flat cloth and then cut and sewn the same way, more or less, that woven cloth would have. But it is possible with a different type of knitting machine and computer software to knit in three dimensions, and so that you will get the whole shirt and there'll be no seams. And you can program it to vary the pattern, change the yarn quickly, change the colors. And so this is becoming more commonly used. Interestingly, the biggest take-up, aside from high-end fashion, has been in knitting sneakers, because you can program this to knit different stitches in different places. So you can have the part where the laces go can be one kind of stitch. The arch can be another stitch. The heel can be another stitch, depending on the need of the shoe. And then you end up with this sort of slightly funny shaped thing that you just fold together and put a sole on. And you've got this whole shoe in one piece. No, and that can be customized. It can also allow manufacturers to make smaller batches and make them closer to the final customer rather than making them in huge quantities far away and then putting them on container ships.
The dress of our modern Eve is symbolic of a progressive textile industry producing many kinds of fabric. Fabric like the lace work of this evening gown. Tough fabrics for the big industrial markets. Fabrics for volume sales to the cutting markets. And fabrics for the great retail markets where they meet the critical eye of another modern Eve who picks and chooses to get the best quality at the lowest price. To keep her buying is the problem of the millman. His is a problem of high quality production at lowest possible cost. Today, the textile is attacking this problem with scientific modernization of mill, materials, and machinery.
I'm Nora Young. Today on Spark, we're looking at textile technology. Right now, my guest is Virginia Postrel, author of The Fabric of Civilization, a look at the technology, history, and cultural impact of textiles.
So, as we talked about, it took a lot of thread to make a lot of fabrics. So, before the Industrial Revolution, typical people didn't have very many clothes or very many bed linens or anything, other kinds of fabrics in their lives. And so if you had wall coverings and rugs and you changed your clothes frequently for different occasions, that was a signifier of wealth. Another way would be the nature of what was woven. Velvets are very complicated to weave. So if you look at, say, Renaissance art, and you see luxurious clothing that signifies wealth, you'll often see velvets, you'll see brocades, which have a pattern woven into the cloth, which is requires a draw loom, which is before Jacquard was this very, very complicated process. You might have silks, which even today, when it's more efficient, it's more expensive because it's a laborious process, raising silkworms in very exacting conditions and reeling off fibers from cocoons.
Yes.
So all of those things. And then one of my favorite ones is there's this famous Tyrian purple dye, which was the great, luxurious, very expensive marker of wealth and eventually of royalty in the ancient world. But in ancient Rome, it was not excluded. You didn't have to be an aristocrat, but you had to have a lot of money. And it's made from the gland of some snails that grow in the Mediterranean. And it's just a horrible process. I mean, there you need a lot of snails to make very much dye. They're smelly. You've got rotting snail flesh. It's disgusting. But the other thing that's fascinating about it is not only do you wind up with this good purple dye, which can be used particularly on wool, it works really well, and that's what the Romans used it on, but the stench stays on the cloth. So it's not like something like indigo, which is the original form of the blue in your blue jeans, is a smelly dyeing process, but the eventual cloth doesn't smell. But this smells. And
even after the clothing is done, it still smells.
Even after it's done, even after it's washed, that is fascinating from the standpoint of status, because what that does is it's a signifier that you have the real thing, that you don't have some alternative. It's not something that's been dyed red and then dyed blue on top. It's not a cheaper purple dye from lichen. This is the real deal, and you can tell because it stinks. And we have satirical poems from ancient Rome about the way rich people's clothes smelled.
And with these dyeing technologies, I mean, in some cases, they were really the keys to, you know, considerable wealth, like the Phoenicians and the Tyrian purple or that. Was it an insect in Mexico? Cochineal?
Yes, yeah. The cochineal. Yeah, the cochineal insect, which is, it lives on a certain type of cactus. It's a tiny little mite. And if you crush them, you get a brilliant red. And over many centuries, they were cultivated and developed by the indigenous people in what is now Mexico. And they were taxed by the Aztecs in, you know, they had to turn in ridiculous amounts of this because it's very valuable. But again, they're very small, and so it takes a lot. And then they were taxed by the Spanish. But even with the taxation, the demand was so great for this, once Europeans saw how fabulous it was, that there was also a big commercial demand on top of the taxes, so that you saw people, there's some great quotes that I found where the local grandees, indigenous grandees in this cochineal growing parts of Mexico, were upset by these nouveau riche cochineal farmers who had suddenly, you know, before there was a European cochineal market, these people didn't wear such fancy clothes and they didn't have so much cacao and all of these things. And so, yes, it was one of the great treasures of the New World from a European's point of view, was not just gold, but was also dye sources, cochineal being the most valuable, but other things like Brazil wood, which is the tree that Brazil is named for, is a very hard wood, and then you would grind it and it made a sort of cheaper red dye.
Hmm. What happened when synthetic dyes came along?
There was quite a revolution. Many things happened. One is it really did upend the production of dyes from plants and animals, all of those markets, because it was disruptive. You know, you went from having lots of indigo grown in India to very little demand for it. And this is in the mid-19th century. The first synthetic dye was invented in 1856 by an 18-year-old chemistry student named William Perkin. He invented a purple dye by accident, but then he developed it into a dye and developed chemical engineering in order to produce the dye at scale. And then you got a lot of other people doing this as a business. It led to the modern chemical industry because suddenly there was a reason to hire a lot of chemists. And then once you have synthetic dyes as a product, then you think about what else you could make. So, for example, Bayer aspirin fame, they were originally a dye house. And so the development of drugs, the development of explosives, the developments of glues, paints, photographic chemicals, all kinds of things came out of the dyes. And also it changed the way we see the world. One of the inspirations for my book was seeing a purple and black dress in the museum at the Fashion Institute in New York that was from 1860. And the colors were so much more vivid than the colors in the preceding part of this exhibition, which was on color and fashion, where only plant and animal dyes had been usable. So you got a much bigger range of colors available. You got lots of greens, which were very difficult to produce before synthetic dyes, and the dyes that had allowed vivid greens in the 19th century were also based on arsenic. So in that case, synthetic dyes were safer as well as more vivid than what had gone before. So it really changed the way we see the world, and it changed our expectations. And it also led to this huge industry, which then in the 20th century developed synthetic fibers and plastics, which were developed together, which then changed textiles again.
Rayon yarns that take a merited place beside every other important development that has added beauty, luxury, ease, and comfort to our daily lives. There are satin, French crepes, flat crepes, taffetas and knitted fabrics of every type. Rayon marquisettes, voiles, ninons, and plain and novelty weaves. Rich brocades, brocatelles, jacquards, reps, twills, moirés, satins, damasks, and plain weaves.
I'm Nora Young, and right now on Spark, my guest is author, columnist, and speaker Virginia Postrel. She's the author of The Fabric of Civilization. We're talking about the technology and cultural impact of textiles throughout history and across cultures. A chunk of the book is about trade and the role that fabric plays in fostering social technologies. So how did trade further things like literacy and numeracy?
Yeah, so textile trade is some of the earliest trade in the world. And in fact, even things we think of as being other things like trade in spices, spices actually included dyestuffs. So trading thread, finished cloth, partially finished cloth, and ingredients for dyeing cloth is some of the earliest trade we have. And the earliest records we have of long-distance trade are cuneiform tablets that are about 4,000 years old, that are from a place called Kanesh, which was the destination, which is in what is now Turkey, but they came from a place called Assur, which is near Mosul in what is now Iraq. And what's interesting about these tablets compared to other cuneiform tablets in that part of the world is that, first of all, they're all about trade and primarily textile trade. Secondly, they're written in a simplified form of the script that was a product of mass literacy, that these traders and many of their wives, who in many cases were the business partner at the home front, were literate, so that they could exchange these letters. And it was a simpler form of the language than what you find in scribal cultures where you don't have literacy. So there's that. And then if you go way forward to, say, you know, the Italian Renaissance period, where you have a lot of trade throughout Europe, those people are literate, but also you're starting to get things like mail service, regular mail service, so people can send letters around. And you also get schools teaching not literacy, but arithmetic. All of those techniques that we learn in elementary school, someone had to invent, and they were developed in this period as Hindu-Arabic numbers came into Europe. Previously, people had been using Roman numerals and abacuses, and now finally they were doing pen and paper calculations, which then leads to bookkeeping. And this is all very much driven by the textile trade.
Yeah. In addition to this book, you've also written books about glamour and about style. I mean, obviously we need clothes to protect ourselves from the elements, but why do you think cloth and clothing have become such a varied and important kind of cultural product?
There is a theory that cloth is always a cultural product. Like, its origins lie in the need to preserve norms of modesty, if you will, or covering the body as the glaciers receded and furs and leather became too hot after thousands and thousands of years of wearing clothes. People didn't want to just go naked again. So that's one theory. But obviously, in many climates, you need clothes to protect you one way or the other. But we have dyed cloth, 6,200-year-old indigo dyed striped cloth from that's been recovered in Peru. So we know that people were creating complicated patterns, going to a lot of trouble to do more than function. We don't know whether that was status, whether it was religious meaning, whether they just thought it was pretty. We don't know why they did it. We just know that there has been this desire from the very earliest times to do something more than protect the body. And I think that goes to very deep human impulses. I mean, we're social creatures. We're creatures who have an aesthetic appreciation that's seemingly made up in our makeup on what exactly seems beautiful to us, may vary somewhat by culture, but that's an element. It's status. It's but it's not just status. It's also something about identity. I'm like that. I'm like these people. I'm not like those people. So that's not status in the hierarchical sense, but just status in a sense of belonging. And that's very much what my 2003 book, The Substance of Style, is about. It's like, why does it matter what things look like? Why would you pay extra for a certain case for your phone when you could get a generic protective case if you're worried about that? Is it just manipulation, or is there something deeper going on?
Mm-hmm. It's a super fascinating book. Thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Virginia Postrel is the author of The Fabric of Civilization, How Textiles Made the World. She's also a visiting fellow at the Smith Institute at Chapman University. You've been listening to Spark. The show is made by Michelle Parisi, Samrui Johannes, Matt Muse, McKenna Hadley-Burke, and me, Nora Young. And by Jen Keane, Hannah Hansel, and Virginia Postrel. And from the Spark Archives, Alice Nasto. Subscribe to Spark on the free CBC Listen app or your favorite podcast app. I'm Nora Young. Talk to you soon.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.